Welcome to Psych for Psychology, a Nystrom & Associates podcast. Our host, Brett Cushing, is a licensed marriage and family therapist at Nystrom. Each week, he talks about all things mental health and therapy with guests, and you get a chance to dive into specific psychology topics that help promote personal development and wellness. And now, your host, Brett.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Psyched for Psychology, the Nystrom & Associates podcast. My name is Krista Overson. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist at our Bloomington clinic, and I am not joined by my steady sidekick, Brett Cushing, today. He is taking some well-deserved time off, but I am here with Mary Anderson, and if you tuned into our last episode, Mary joined me and was talking about kind of an overview of therapy with children. And we got very excited at several points because today we're going to talk more and delve more into early childhood mental health. And so last time was more of an overview of just children, but now we get to kind of get into it a little more. So Mary, if you wouldn't mind just kind of going through your kind of your title and how long you've been doing what you do.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a marriage and family therapist as well. My specialty is early childhood mental health. I've been doing this since like 2009. It's my second career. My first career was child care. And that leads right into what's important in early childhood mental health.
Right. Right.
It's knowing what's typical.
Yes.
So all my years of typical children in a childcare setting and knowing what developmentally is appropriate for what age groups is super important when you're working with early childhood.
Well, I think this is so, I'm really excited about this too, because one of my first questions I had for Mary when we were talking about this was, okay, so early childhood mental health, like what ages are we talking? Just first of all.
Yep. Birth and sometimes pre-birth, if we already know there's trauma for the mom, up to age six.
Okay, got it. And so after knowing that, the first thing that I think a lot of people might wonder is like, okay, so like, why would a one-year-old or a two-year-old need therapy? I think this is a big misunderstood topic, right?
Sure, absolutely. So a lot of our referrals come from primary care physicians, public health places, childcare settings, any place where they feel like they see children, they see typical development, and they see there's something going on with a little, but they don't really can't put their finger on what it is.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah. So some of the tenets of early childhood mental health that start are eating, sleeping, and pooping.
Yeah, like the really basic things.
Yes.
Actually, that's a great point. So,
so if those systems are off, then we know it could be the early signs of mental health.
Sure.
So the better we can intervene and take care of it early, the better.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So they might, the parents or the doctor, they might start to see things like, what would be a common thing that people might see that would bring them in? Like my kid's not sleeping.
Right.
Okay.
Like the child won't sleep.
Won't sleep
at all.
Oh,
and they've kind of tried everything.
Sure.
A lot of what we see in those early times, it's either trauma that's been undiagnosed or goodness of fit.
Wow.
So goodness of fit is how the parent's temperament and the child's temperament meld together.
Wow.
Or don't meld together.
See, and again, this is something that you don't hear about.
No.
Right? And I think there's a lot of, when you were talking about the child won't sleep, I think there's a lot of people that might just say like, oh, well, you know, Johnny's never been a good sleeper. And, but like, it might not occur to them like to get help. Right?
Right.
Or it could be that the parents feel ashamed and feel like, what's wrong with us that we haven't been able to help our kid figure out sleep.
Yep.
Right?
And that's why this is a dyadic system, because a lot of time how the caregiver, we're going to say mom, but how mom feels about her ability to take care of this child will affect the child's mental health. So while the client, the child is the client, we really work with the parents to be like, hey, you're doing the best job. You're doing all the things. So really reassuring the caregiver so that they are more calm as they care for the child.
Wow.
Because a lot of times it's our anxiety, or the other time we see kids that, okay, so I'm great at stories. If you guys tuned in last time.
Yes, we love our stories.
So I had a family that I was referred, 2.5-year-old. Family was going to be getting kicked out of their living circumstances because this child's tantrums were so huge.
Oh my goodness.
So I asked the public health nurse, I said, are there any other children in the home? Because I had a therapist, and any of you that know me, I try as much as I can to get many people therapist into early childhood mental health.
Yes.
So I dragged one of my coworkers with, trying to entice her.
Always in. Teaching, right?
And she is an early childhood specialist now. But anyway, I dragged her with. And when we got there, there was this very activated 2.5-year-old, but there was a little 7-month-old in a walker. The 7-month-old had the biggest smile that you've ever seen the whole hour and a half we were there.
The 7-month-old? Okay. And the one that was tantruming was how old again?
2.5.
2.5. Okay.
So when we left, I asked my coworker, what'd you think of the baby? Oh, he's so smiley. Said, no, that was a fright. So he knew that if he didn't smile, he didn't get his needs met.
Whoa.
So upon another visit that we went there with him, we got there at 11:30 and I heard the baby in the bed. And so I said, oh, mom. He's awake. Can I go get him up? Assuming he'd been up and he was down for his morning nap. And mom's response was, he's fine. Just leave him.
Oh.
And I said, oh, I'd love to go get him. I'm like, so how long did he nap this morning? She goes, well, he's been in there. He's fine. So the child hadn't eaten at noon. I mean, at all since the night before.
Uh-oh.
And when I went in there, this child just looked up at me with the biggest smile ever.
Oh,
and he had
gosh.
To be starving. He was super soaked through his... But he had already known at 7 months that if I don't smile, I don't get what I need.
That is so interesting. And it almost... I'm like, it makes me want to cry a little
bit.
It
does.
Because a couple reasons. One, kids... I mean, babies, it's like they're so smart. Mm-hmm. They know what to do to get their needs met,
yes.
right? And then the other piece is just like... How many people saw that kid beaming and smiling
and
had no idea? So was
my coworker. She was like, he's so happy. I'm like, no.
Well,
so I was able to explain.
I was going to say, so the other thing I was wondering, I'm so glad you picked up on that. And how did you differentiate? Was it like that his eyes were really wide or like kind of, how did you differentiate the fright?
No 7-month-old smiles for an hour and a half.
Okay. That's another piece that's
right. So you got to know development.
There you go.
You got to know.
Yep.
In an hour and a half, this baby's going to be hungry or fussy or want to get out of the jumper or look at us for attention, fuss.
Yeah.
Anything.
So you were,
they paced it on. So I believe that 2.5-year-old saved that baby's life.
Because of the tantrums. See? And do you think that was the 2-year-old kind of knowing, like, I need to get help for my...
No, I think the 2-year-old didn't get helped either.
Okay, sure.
So the only way he could get any attention was
by
to
tantruming.
Scream.
See?
Yes.
Okay, this is a whole other thing that I think needs to just... I want to point out is I think people think like, oh, well, these two siblings are raised in the same house. They probably have the same experience. Look at how different those two things are. And that will continue into adulthood for each of them.
So as we talk about temperament.
Temperament. Yep.
So mom's view was the baby's perfect. And the 2.5-year-old is just a terror.
There you go. A little monster, right?
Because they're different personalities.
See?
And different dads.
Yep.
So that plays into sometimes to how parents feel about their kids. And
true.
How they feel about the spouse.
True.
Yeah. So another example. So this will lead into why we have occupational therapy. Why do I feel like I'm passionate about it? Because I had a kiddo in daycare, this before I was a mental health worker, that I had wonderful infant caregivers. Like they were fabulous. But we had this baby we could not soothe.
Oh.
And upon coming to the daycare, the mom basically came in, said, here's your papers, here's the baby, I got to go to work. So typically the parents want to sit back there and whatever. Well, this child was
really... Oh, and like hang out, you mean, before they drop off their kid?
Yeah, and just get to know the caregivers.
Sure,
and
sure.
More typical.
Oh, right. And be like, who are these people that are going to be hanging out with my child all day?
Sure.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Well, story goes on. Well, she had already been removed. This baby was like 4 months old, removed from 2 in-home cares because the caregiver just couldn't handle it. This baby cried a lot, didn't sleep at all.
So the caregivers were having a hard time. Yep. Well, they probably couldn't soothe the baby either, right?
So I knew, and mom couldn't. Mom was just fed up, single mom trying to deal with this baby who's crying all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she felt like a failure. Mm-hmm. But what we did is, because I knew enough about sensory stuff, I literally went and bought like 5 blankets at the store to see if it was sensory, and it was too rough or too soft or too whatever.
Wow.
Finally found a blanket that we could hold him with and comfort him.
Yep.
But when we'd put him in bed, wake up, scream. So what happened one day is one of my caregivers bent down by his crib to get something, and she could feel air coming off of like under another crib, but it was shooting kind of over that way, just our regular air vent.
Yeah.
And that was enough. So we moved his crib and he would sleep. So he was so highly sensitive that any of these things just wakened him.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So you first determined that you figured out a way to soothe him until you put him down.
Right.
And then when you put him down, you were able to determine that was it the airflow that was bothering him?
He was so super sensitive. Oh. So then we could get him to sleep at daycare. Yeah. So then his mood was better for mom.
Oh, I can imagine.
So things went better there.
Yeah.
But if we hadn't got that 4-month-old.
Yeah. No. Again, it just makes you wonder, like, what would become of these kids?
And how many kids are suffering when it's something we can, and parents are suffering.
Right.
Something we can help with.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So this experience you had back when you were doing childcare.
Yeah, I was actually in my grad program and doing the daycare center.
Wow. That's incredible.
So, yeah.
That's incredible.
So a lot of early childhood stuff. So I wanted to mention the last one. Mm-hmm. We mentioned a couple of things.
Yes.
One thing I want to get to is developmental repair.
Yes.
But the other thing I want to get to is inter-utero trauma.
I'm so glad you, brought that up.
So, I had a kiddo, again, public health, knew me really well. So they called me in on this case where there had been a severe accident in town. Mm. Some of you maybe remember the Woodlake accident where like 5 kids died in a bus. A drunk driver ran into the back of a bus.
When was this? Because I don't remember.
This was probably like in...
Sure.
Like 2003 or 4.
Okay, sure. Wow.
So this kiddo, by the time I was called in, was 4. And he was a curtain crawler. Like I came into the room
curtain crawler?
He would run behind you on the couch and he would jump over his mom and dad and he was just everywhere, completely dysregulated.
Wow.
And so I'm asking all the trauma things. It was an intact family.
Yep.
They had no accidents they could think of, nothing. And pretty soon the kid, like a 14-year-old, was doing homework in the kitchen and he said, "What about the bus accident?" And this child, who again was 4 at the time, just stopped dead in his tracks in the middle of the room.
Just because the sibling mentioned the bus accident?
Yes.
Whoa.
And I said, "All right, what about it?" And the mom's like, "That wasn't it. I was pregnant with him. He wasn't even born yet." And I said, "Okay, tell me more about the bus accident."
There you go. Okay, I love that because I think that's a common thing that happens is parents will be like, "Well, it couldn't be that because."
Yes.
And I understand why, because they're thinking this baby wasn't even born yet.
Exactly.
Sure. But you knowing what you know, you persisted. So
that kid told me, like, just stopped.
Wow. Yes, his behavior told you, right? When he stopped in his tracks, his hyper, like you said, curtain crawler.
And he literally sat down and listened to us then as we talked about the bus accident.
Oh my gosh. Then he was super focused on you guys.
So what had happened is 2 of the kids that died in that bus accident were the next door neighbors of the cousins of these kids.
Okay.
So mom was there to support her sister and her nieces through this.
Wow.
Going to the funerals. So what we know about early childhood mental health is all that cortisol is just going washing over this baby as the mom is stressed.
Yes. Right.
So then the dad says, "Oh, yeah, you know, when we drive down the road and he sees a bus, he just freaks out when he's in his car seat."
Mm. Wow.
And mom's like, "Oh, yeah, and he would just scream when the kids would get on the bus to go to school in the morning."
You guys, I am, like, kind of freaking out right now. This is so huge because I want to make sure you understand what Mary is saying. So she is basically saying that this baby, this client, right, was 4 when he came to work with Mary as the therapist. And this at when this baby was not even born, this four-year-old, now four-year-old, was in utero, and this horrible accident happened. His mother, who was carrying him at the time, was involved in supporting the families of those. So again, the kid, this little baby in utero didn't see a bus, didn't...
Heard about the bus.
He heard about the bus in utero, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, people can write off things like this thinking, something I hear a lot of people say actually is like, even with toddlers, like they won't remember.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, yes, they will. So now will.
We know with all the brain research, we know better.
Yes. So, and actually, I'm so glad that you do tell stories, Mary, because I think this is such a powerful illustration and helps us kind of retain the information. Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch back on a couple things. One was you mentioned cortisol. So with trauma, the body releases all sorts of different chemicals and hormones, I think. And cortisol is one that gets released when we're under distress. Mm-hmm. So imagine being this mom, you're pregnant, you're a family member.
Her sister's
right, kids. Was very closely involved with this horrible tragedy, mm-hmm. right? So the cortisol that gets released, again, we're not blaming the mom. We're just mm-hmm. saying she went through something distressing herself. Mm-hmm. But of course, they're not thinking this is going to affect the kid.
Right.
So there they are. They're finally now, the kid's four. He's all over the place. Do you mm-hmm. remember what it was that referred, like why they said, Mary,
we need public health. She's public just health. Like,
okay.
She goes, I don't know what's going on. I've been involved with this family for a long time. They're really good. They parent really well, but this kid is just off the wall.
Okay.
So go see what you think.
Okay. Which again, and you did, but I think this is another important point to emphasize is just, you could be doing the most competent job as a parent.
Absolutely.
So that's why we're just trying to say, excuse me, it's not about shaming any parents. It's not about mm-hmm. inadequate parenting, but even something like in utero trauma can be so impactful. Mm-hmm. So you tell the story, kind of getting back to the scene, right? So you're telling the story. This kid's like zeroed in on you guys and mm-hmm. listening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then kind of what happened from there?
Yeah. So you're wondering about like, what do we do?
So right? Sure. Or anything else you yeah. want to share from this point on. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the main things that I know helped this child is we brought a bus on their farm and the people got on the bus and off the bus and we got to, so exposure therapy.
There you go.
Yep. Got to meet the bus driver.
Yep.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Just did a lot of exposure therapy and talked to him now because now he's verbal.
Yep.
So we could say to him, when you feel nervous or when you get scared, you can go to mommy and daddy for a hug.
Yes.
You can. So we gave him ways to handle the fear that nobody had talked about.
Mm. It was like this unspoken fear.
Absolutely.
No words.
Nobody knew.
Nobody knew. And the kid couldn't tell you.
No.
Couldn't tell anyone.
No.
Because the kid didn't know either.
Well, the thing is about pre-verbal trauma is they don't have words.
Okay. I was clearing my throat. Pre-verbal trauma.
Yep, yes.
Go ahead.
So once they know how to talk and yep. something happens, they can talk about it.
Ah, yes.
Before they talk, they don't have words for what happened to them, but wow. they can often play it out.
Right.
So that's why the play therapy part's so important. And it's so important to have the parent there so that you can see as the child's playing out the trauma. Oh, it looks like you need a hug. Mommy would love to give you a hug.
Wow.
So you tell them how to help their children with their feelings as yep. they play them out.
Yep.
So I will say things like, that would make me so sad.
Wow.
I would need a hug.
Because you're helping label
right.
what you're seeing and what...
And you're giving them a strategy of how to help when he feels that way.
Wow. This is so interesting. I love it. So again, I'm really glad we're clarifying about pre-verbal trauma, which is prior to when the child can speak. Mm-hmm. And then even in utero trauma, mm-hmm. where you're still basically in the womb, because kids can hear things. Kids can mm-hmm. pick up on...
They get the cortisol.
They get the cortisol and the chemicals. They get, I guess, what are some other things that might influence them? Emotions, I'm guessing.
Well, domestic violence is
sure.
huge when
sure.
kids are...
Good point.
In utero.
Good point.
So anything loud, anything whatever.
Yep.
So I'll have parents say they're so sensitive.
Sure.
They're so super sensitive. Like if we just raise our voice, they crouch. It's like...
Yeah. Yeah.
And no, nothing's happened. I haven't been with that guy since I was pregnant.
Ah, and you're thinking that matters.
Dang. right?
Yes.
For my brain.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. So there's many reasons why if people are concerned about their child or mm-hmm. if there's been life circumstances. Mm. One of the things that breaks my heart is they'll bring in 5, 6, 7 year olds because maybe a parent has died, but they have a 2-year-old at home.
Oh my gosh.
He's fine.
Yes.
I'm like, nope, we need to see him.
Oh my goodness.
So here's an example of that. I had a 3-year-old, 3.5-year-old girl that was brought in. Mom had died suddenly. Mm. And dad brought the baby with.
Mm-hmm.
And the baby wanted to jump out of dad's arms and come right to me. Whoa. Never met me. So what we know about typical development is like 8 and 9 months old, they have that Klingon. They just want to hold on to their parent.
Yeah.
And this kid just wanted to jump.
So you're thinking that's not typical, perhaps.
Correct.
Yep. Yep.
So I need to do work with that baby and that dad, as well as this 3.5-year-old around all this.
Yes.
So when you see those things, that's like, okay, clue, because I know what typical is.
Yep.
So when you see not typical, it's much easier to recognize.
Yes, exactly.
So
in that example, so that you said their mother had died suddenly and there was a 3.5-year-old and then the baby was maybe 9 months.
Well, when I saw him, he was 8 months, but when she died, he was like 4 months.
Okay. So I suppose there's a time lag where between getting into therapy, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And people realizing they need it. So the little girl was crying all the time and asking for mom.
Well, of course.
Right.
Exactly. Right. So then when the baby leaped, wanted to go to you, I mean, how did you help that dad with that? Mm-hmm. Like, to explain to him what you noticed about that.
Because, of course, he's still grieving, too.
Of course.
So you got all three of these. So.
Yep.
Basically, I just said, hey, Dad, he really needs a hug from you right now.
Yeah.
I think Dad was a little flat because he was depressed.
Of course.
So the child saw my smiling face and welcoming.
Was like, I want that.
Yeah.
Yep. I want to go to you.
And there's some attachment going on because I was 4 months old. My mom died.
Mm.
My dad's depressed.
Yep.
So I'm not getting my emotional needs met the way I need. No, nobody's fault. Mm-hmm. Again, it's just this is the way it was.
Exactly.
So fast forward like 2.5 months.
Okay.
They came in the door.
Yeah.
And the little boy buried his head in dad's shoulder.
And you're thinking, like, yay! Which again, adults who didn't know better might be like, oh, he doesn't want to come hug me anymore. And it's like, no, you're thinking this is great.
Yes. This is exactly what we've been working towards.
Like he prefers dad
to,
he prefers his actual attachment figure,
to
me, which is good. And you, of course, we're like, I'm not taking that personally. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, wow. That's amazing. Now, is this a good segue maybe to talk about developmental repair a little bit?
Sure. So one of the things we mentioned last time that we visited, Krista brought up that even adults kind of can go back and fix things that happen early on.
Very early on. So let's say
that a child was 13 and she was sexually molested.
Mm-hmm.
That adult is going to have carried that into adulthood.
Adulthood, absolutely. Right? Yes.
So just like our younger kids carry the inability to repair early small t traumas.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we always talk about is if we get kids in who don't know how to play.
Mm.
So if we get an 8 or 9 year old in and they just look at toys, but they really can't develop toy themes, we'll bring in all the younger toys. We'll bring in the ball castle, it's called. We'll bring in the shape sorter. We'll bring in the, and we play with them and we let them play.
Wow.
And they can repair some of their early work.
This is an adult, you guys. So like having the adult play with toys that are meant for very small children, very young children, right?
Yeah.
And so when are you down on the floor kind of sitting there and.
Yep. And we'll talk
about whatever.
Yep. As we play.
Well, not whatever. Of course, I'm sure there's more point to it than that. But but you're kind of just asking questions and.
Yeah. Or that 8 or 9 year old who just can't do play therapy because they literally haven't had access to toys.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't had the freedom to play. Yep. So I find this in kids whose moms or dads are OCD and they need things put away. They can't mix toys. They need everything picked up.
So they can't play. Yeah, go ahead.
So then they can't develop their play skills.
Because they're so aware of, like, we can't make a mess. We have to put everything away. We have to put this away before we take that out. Instead of just, like, a lot of kids will just take out every toy they can see,
mix and match and whatever.
Wow.
And then we sort, right?
Wow.
And then we do that. So, but what they do is they do a developmental repair. So when I talk to parents about, hey, leave your younger toys out, even though you think the kids have grown out of them, leave them out.
Like at home, right?
Yes. Yep. And parents will constantly say, oh, yeah, because we'll go to the neighbors or we'll go to the niece and nephews and they play with baby toys and they're 10. I said, yeah, they know what they need.
Wow.
So they're doing their own baby repair that they need as they play.
Yep.
They just get that feeling. Dump and pouring is a developmental stage that all kids need to go through.
Wow.
So if you have an 18 to 2-year-old, 18 months to two, they'll dump. We call them the dump and pours at the daycare. But now all of a sudden you get a 5 or 6-year-old who's doing that. So in my play therapy, I'm like, oh, is that fun? Let's do that. Can we dump some more?
So you're paying attention to just the action of dumping out a bucket of toys.
Yep, because we know developmentally they maybe never got to do that.
Mm.
So we help repair that
because
we know that developmentally things go with the brain development.
Yep.
So those things coincide with how the brain and the emotions are coming online.
Wow.
If they're able to do typical childhood things.
Sure. And one of those typical childhood things is to... Dump and pour, make a mess. I think that is so important too.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of times parents can get stressed out about that and feel like, why do they have to take out every toy?
Absolutely.
And it's kind of like, well, that's a developmental like milestone in a way, right?
Absolutely.
Yep. You know, I'm like, this has been on my mind since we started talking about in utero and kind of developmental repair. So, because I was going to give a personal example, because of course it's all about me, you know?
Oh,
wow. No, I know we're therapists. You get it. So when I was just thinking about how when I was in utero, when my mom was pregnant with me, her mother died by suicide.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's always been something where I'm like, what could be? So something like that. What could be kind of the impact of that for, like, if I were coming to you just as a person off the street saying, hey, this happened, like, I'm guessing you would be interested in that.
Well, how hard is that?
Right.
Because you think about where mom's mind is. If mom was close to grandma, like, where was her mind the whole time she was pregnant with you? And she still had to go on with life.
Right.
And did she have time to grieve?
Right.
You know?
Well, and they had a complicated relationship where they were not close.
Yeah.
So I think that was even
just
more.
Just the grieving.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. The grieving.
And then you're a baby. They're needing all this stuff and needing all this emotions.
Well, and you know what's super funny is my parents still, you know how parents continue to tell stories. So like I'm almost 40. My sister is 40 and my older sister. So she came first and she had like the great temperament, like just easy temperament, right?
Yes.
And then I came along and I was fussy.
Yep.
And my parents like still bring it up sometimes where they're like, you could not be soothed. So I'm kind of putting pieces of the puzzle together that part of that was, I think, my temperament, but I think part of it was maybe the piece about my grandma's death.
Think about where mom's brain was at that time.
Sure.
So who could soothe a baby when my own brain's on fire?
Right. Right. Exactly. And this was back when I think therapy is much more acceptable now.
Sure.
But I don't think at that time it was like, oh, I'll go talk to someone.
No.
I think it was plus with even suicide being such a shame, you know, shameful, stigmatized thing. Yep. It was like, well, we don't talk about this.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah, that popped into my head.
So many actors play into what's going on with the baby. You know, there's a curriculum out there. It's called Who's Minding the Baby? That would talk a lot
like
about
that. Who's Minding the Baby?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yep.
But the main one that we use in, it's called Child Parent Psychotherapy by Alicia Lieberman.
Okay. Nice.
I'm trained in that and that's a fantastic. I know we have a couple other therapists at Nystrom trained in that as well.
Sure.
And we're really developing our early childhood program through Nystrom where we have about 20 of us providers who like meet the qualifications.
Nice.
So
for parent-child psychotherapy?
For early childhood.
Or for early childhood,
thank you. So just a designation of people that are we're all learning to be experts in our field, right?
Exactly. So,
yeah.
Which is so cool. So the parent-child psychotherapy, who kind of what ages is that appropriate for?
The 0 to 5.
The 0 to 5. Okay, nice. Yep. Nice.
It's all based on
youngs. Well, I know this came up recently. A friend of mine was asking about what's the difference between parent-child psychotherapy and what's called parent-child interaction therapy, which is PCIT.
Oh, PCIT.
Yeah.
No, I'm not as versed in that, but that's another good
one for young kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Early childhood.
Okay. So I think sometimes people use those maybe thinking they're the same, but it sounds like they're not the same.
No, this one's CPP, so child-parent psychotherapy. The other one's PCIT, parent-child interaction therapy.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, so as we're kind of wrapping up, I mean, I've so enjoyed our time together, and I hope that we can do more episodes because clearly there's just so many like things to delve into. But I guess for those listening who might be wondering, what are there any kind of things that parents can be looking for in their children 0 to 5 or things that like when to know, like, do I need to take this to the next level?
Yeah. So most kids that are adopted, even if they're adopted as babies.
Yep. As we know now, we know differently now.
Yes. Because we know the in utero time is hard.
Yeah.
Getting a new baby when you're adopting is hard. Mm-hmm. If you get older children, they've been through trauma or they wouldn't have been in the system to be adopted. But my thing is, if you've had trauma happen to you while you're pregnant or that baby is little or you've had a lot of moves, just go in and have somebody evaluate.
Okay, I love that. Doing. Just like not even have to have an extreme reason.
Right.
I love it. So what was it if you have moved a lot?
Yeah. Or you've had trauma.
Sure.
If you've had car accidents that they've been in, if there's been a fire.
Sure.
I had a little one come to me. I don't know if we have time for this. I'll have more stories.
Oh, we have time.
Okay. So I had a little one come to me that was 6. Family of 8 kiddos.
Yeah.
Mom didn't know why this kid was acting out and just like wouldn't listen and had tantrums and whatever.
Yep.
And as we're playing, he keeps making fires.
Wow.
In the play. Not real fires,
right,
obviously.
But pretend fires.
Pretend fires.
Yep.
More interviews with mom here when this kid was 2.
Yeah.
They had a family fire in the middle of the night and all the family members. So mom was going to get the girls. Dad was going to get the boys. They both understood the other got this little guy. So he was left in the house. Dad went in and found him. But by that time he'd wandered into the kitchen. So he wasn't in his bedroom.
Sure.
Found him, brought him out. And they all were in a little playhouse. It was freezing. It was Minnesota winter.
Yes.
All the fire trucks come. And she's like, we talk about it plenty, but nobody talked about his experience.
Wow.
Of how it happened.
Wow.
So once he was able to talk that out and play it out and understand that, yes, he'd been in the house longer. And yes, this all happened.
Wow.
And his behavior settled down.
Wow.
So
I think that's a really important example because, again, I think a lot of us, it hits different when there's a story. It's like why the use of parables and stories, right?
Yes.
And so I think, again, if you're not sure, I think the first thing you said was if you're not sure and you've been through a lot of change or possibly trauma, go and get an evaluation.
Yeah.
And if there's repetitive themes, if there's something, it's like suddenly their behavior has changed and they're doing these different things, then that's also something to pay attention to. And don't, and a message for parents, I mean, I don't have children, so it's kind of easy for me to say, I think, but try not to be so hard on yourselves, parents, right?
Follow your gut.
Follow your gut.
So Dr. Marty Erickson from the University of Minnesota said we only have to be perfect parents 25% of the time.
That's so helpful.
And our kids will be okay.
I love that. So, thank you for saying that.
Yes.
25%?
Yes.
You would think that
so
number would be.
Everybody could do that, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So.
Oh, man. Well, I am so grateful for this time and you guys, we will definitely have to come back again in the future. And thanks again, Mary.
Yeah.
Keep doing the amazing work.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, you're welcome. Keep doing the amazing work you do, and we'll catch you all on the next one.
Thank you as always for listening, and please be sure to leave us a review. While this podcast can't be a replacement for therapy, we hope you enjoyed our discussion today and join us again next time. NYSERM & Associates is always available to those who are struggling. If you find yourself in need of support and help, please check us out at nystromcounseling.com.